Good evening. This is Mae Bressel in Carmel, California. This is tape number 353, September the 8th, 1978. Before I get into the Robert Groden testimony before the House Select Committee on Assassinations that took place on Wednesday, September the 6th, I do want to mention a couple of follow-ups to my tape on James Earl Ray real quickly that I didn't include last week. Because I mentioned on the printed sheet that you got it on the tape that James Earl Ray talked about a date in 1964 where he was in contact with the late Clyde Watts of Oklahoma regarding a name that he had, Randolph Irving Rosen. And nobody on the committee asked about the date 1964, and his attorney, Mark Lane, didn't say anything about it. But going back to my earlier Martin Luther King articles, I found a United Press story, San Francisco Chronicle. This is April the 18th, 1968, 2 weeks after Martin Luther King was killed. And the headline on the article, strangely enough, said, FBI quotes, there's a plot in the King assassination. They went on to say that Eric Gold and at least one other person, they thought alleged to be his brother, were involved in this assassination. And later articles showed that they located Jerry Ray, the brother of this alleged Eric Starvo Galt, but they never charged him. Many articles came out after Martin Luther King was killed saying that the brother of Eric Starvo Galt was a co-conspirator, but Jerry Ray was never arrested or charged as a conspirator. But the article went on to say that Eric Starvo Galt was in New Orleans in 1964 and in 1965, and those are the dates that General Clyde Watts and General Walker were in New Orleans and in the South, and they were organizing, fighting the desegregation in the South when, at the time that Robert Kennedy picked up General Walker and had argued with their civil rights policies. James Earl Ray, according to the UPI story, if that was Eric Starvo Galt, wasn't even in jail. This particular Eric Starvo Galt is in New Orleans in 1964 and 65, and he's dancing in Birmingham in 1967, and he's in Long Beach in 1967, and February, again, he's back in Long Beach in 68 before he comes back east in March for becoming involved in some way in the killing of Martin Luther King. But the date 64 is important because not only was he mentioning as late as 1978 about that date, but the man whose identity he took on was out and was in New Orleans at the identical time that this Eric Starvo Galt, James Earl Ray, was supposed to be in the Missouri penitentiary. I don't know what to make of all that, but I do want to pass it on because not only was he in New Orleans many times making these telephone calls and having contacts there, but I have another article from April the 17th, a day before that, 1968, where Sheriff Mel Bailey said that he thought there was a conspiracy to kill Martin Luther King, that the pump rifle wouldn't have a spent shell on the bathroom floor, you'd have to pull back on the pump, and that discarded outside the rooming house was not only the Remington 30.06, but it was in a Browning automatic rifle packing box, and the Sheriff Bailey suggested that two rifles could be used, which this is what James Earl Ray was trying to say. Another rifle could kill Martin Luther King, and his could be put there to make a patsy out of him. And the sheriff was saying that an expended shell found in the bathroom could match the Remington, but it could be shot at an earlier date and planted to match the Remington. And I think that is interesting because that's what the whole single bullet theory is about. Were other shells and bullets shot at John, not just shells, the bullets at John Connally and John Kennedy? And was this bullet, it wasn't brought out before the hearings today, was it planted on a stretcher to link this to the weapon that Lee Harvey Oswald allegedly shot? That was in 1963, and in 1968, Sheriff Mel Bailey is asking that question about planting evidence against this James Earl Ray, Eric Starvo Galt. At one point in the hearings, they were trying to pressure James Earl Ray to think of somebody who could confirm that he had contacts with another party. And he said, well, I gave telephone numbers out. Why didn't you ever check those out? And the House Select Committee sit like a bunch of eunuchs and with no motion, no expression, and no answers. But December 28, 1974, there was an Associated Press article that James Earl Ray gave some telephone numbers to an attorney from Nashville, name of Z.T. Osborne. That's interesting because Albert Osborne from Tennessee was the agent from the Pentagon from the Defense Industry Security Command with Lee Harvey Oswald. And this Osborne, an attorney who has since died, another witness not available, had two phone numbers that James Earl Ray gave him. And these were checked out in 1974, and Mr. Osborne, before he passed away, or maybe he passed away because of it, reported that one number that James Earl Ray had at Baton Rouge was the Parish County, the official under the influence of the Teamsters Union official in Baton Rouge. It had to do with the Teamsters organization in Baton Rouge. And the second phone number had to do in the New Orleans area with an agent from the Middle East, an organization that was concerned with Martin Luther King's getting into politics and support of the Palestinian Arab cause. So there were Middle Eastern agents here, and that would confirm Robert Byron Watson's story, or it's worth going into, that the people who killed Martin Luther King were involved with the Middle East, Mr. Habash and Hadid, and that they were active with the Palestinian groups. And also the research of David Ferry down at Baton Rouge with Carlos Marcello, and that was supposed to be an escape route for Lee Harvey Oswald through Baton Rouge. That was an area that where Joe Cooper, the writer for the Tattler, National Tattler, was exposing the links to the Kennedy assassination at Baton Rouge, and he was blown up and murdered, and the newspaper folded, and that was the end of the expose of the Baton Rouge organization, the Teamsters Organized Crime Group. So I think it's interesting that James Earl Ray was visiting a party, an engineer in the International Trade Mart where Clay Shaw had worked. He had phone number in Baton Rouge, where these other connections linked to the Kennedy assassination and also the Middle Eastern agents in the New Orleans area. After John and Nellie Connolly testified before the House Select Committee, Robert Groden was allowed to testify on the photographic evidence of conspiracy, and he seemed to suggest that he was representing all the researchers, or all the critics, he called them, the critics. And the House Select Committee, I think, let him give his testimony, and then they figured, we'll let the whole thing drop. And he gave areas that should be gone into, and at least, again, they will be sold, bound by the government printing office. You can buy his testimony. It was great. Then you can check the further hearings of the House Select Committee and their past work, and you'll see the areas that they didn't get into. He went into the time sequence of the Abraham Zapruder film and tried to explain to that dense, thick committee back in Washington, D.C., that Oswald couldn't get off more than 3 shots in 6.5 seconds. Even if Mrs. Connolly was right, that she heard a first shot that went in John Kennedy's back and through the throat, and a second that hit John Connolly, and a third that hit John Kennedy in the head. There is still a man named Mr. Teague who was hit by a bullet that hit the curb and ricocheted. That would make four, and that would make a conspiracy. And he showed the Abraham Zapruder film and the sequence of the frames. The next thing he talked about was the flight path of the bullet and the impossibility of the course of direction, which the next day Cyril Wecht went into extensively in the trajectory. He showed how 2 shots came so close to John Connolly and John Kennedy and yet appeared to be coming from different bullets that it would suggest a crossfire because Lee Harvey Oswald couldn't pull a bolt-action rifle that quickly to take those shots so close together. He showed the fatal headshot of John Kennedy going backwards, which the 9 doctors and panelists the following day could not explain and hardly tried to explain. They passed things off as if it's a matter of opinion, and Cyril Wecht kept saying, no, with ballistics and scientific evidence, it isn't a matter of opinion. When you can put a thing to a scientific test, the test should be made. He showed volume 18 of the Warren Commission hearings. This is Robert Groden. Pages 70 to 71, where the Warren Report was printed, the frames of the Abraham Zapruder film were printed backwards so that it looked as if the fatal headshot went forward, and he mentioned that a critic of the Warren Report had noticed this. He gives no credit to anybody who's done all this work, even though he came in fairly late in the game. He doesn't talk about the flight path and Robert Cutler, and he doesn't talk about the person who first noticed the reversal of the frames. But the main thing is that he gave a very good presentation. He showed a picture of Dealey Plaza, a blow-up of the window, several people's pictures, one by Robert Hughes and Tom Brewer, and one Agent Powell of Army Intelligence, and these were up at the window at the time of the assassination, and none showed the body of Lee Harvey Oswald in the window. He showed the Algin photo of the Dow Tex building, which is directly behind the car, as John Kennedy had turned the corner and was going down the street. The Dow Tex was in back. And he showed the photograph of a man on the fire escape with what looked like a rifle coming out of the Dow Tex building. Now, he stressed about a man named Mr. Miltier. I'll describe him to you in a minute. And he felt that the blow-up of this picture looked like Mr. Miltier and suggested that Miltier could have been at Dealey Plaza and that the commission should look into this. Mr. Miltier is a man who made a tape recording with the Miami Police Department 2 weeks before John Kennedy was killed, and he said that a high-powered rifle was going to be used to kill John Kennedy, and that it would be assembled and brought into a building, and then somebody else would shoot this rifle, another rifle, and there would be a patsy who would take the blame for the murder. And this tape recording was given to the Warren Commission. They were told, while they did their work, that there was a patsy, that somebody was going to be set up. And when Lee Harvey Oswald was arrested, he said, "I am a patsy." And then when he saw the pictures, he said, "That's not my body. There's a head attached, but it's not my body." And then Lee Harvey Oswald was shot in the jail, and they knew that there was a plan. The Warren Commission knew there was a plan to kill John Kennedy in Miami 2 weeks earlier. They not only didn't go into that, but when Abraham Bolden, the Secret Service agent, told them there was a plan to kill John Kennedy 3 weeks earlier in Chicago, and it involved a man named Oswald, they put Bolden in a prison mental hospital for 6-7 years, the way they put away Martha Mitchell and the way they put away Grace Stevens, if they know too much, or Walter Scott. When we talk about human rights and the Soviet Union, I think it's about time to compile a letter and put a full-page ad in some newspaper and let Jimmy Carter know what we do with people here that are political prisoners. But he did talk about Miltier because it appeared that that was Miltier's face in the Dow Tex building. And he didn't mention in his presentation that Eugene Brading of organized crime was arrested and then released in the Dow Tex building, that he had been using a false name and was out on parole. But he did get a lot. I don't want to criticize Grodin's testimony because it was really good. He showed Mary Moorman pictures of a stockade fence behind the grassy knoll area and a parking lot, and there's a concrete wall. And from the pictures that Mary Moorman took, you can see somebody identified there, a person. And after the assassination, that party got up and fled towards the railroad tracks. The pictures of Moorman were supported, he showed, by pictures of Emmett Hudson, who was a witness, and the Willis, Philip Willis pictures, that support the Moorman pictures, that there is a figure there. He showed, Grodin showed the Zapruder film, the site when Abraham Zapruder was taking the scenes of John Kennedy. He had, through the view of his camera, you could also see that man on the cement wall, what appears to be a man in a firing position, and he showed that. Robert Grodin showed photographic evidence of areas of conspiracy that the new House Select Committee, or the old one, it's ready to go out of business, should have investigated. He showed pictures of the umbrella man with his umbrella, and he turned it around counterclockwise when John Kennedy was passing. For those of you that don't take Penn Jones' newsletter, you should, The Continuing Inquiry. His latest issue has an article on how he found the umbrella man in Dallas, Texas, and he's never been interviewed before, but he's willing to go before the House Select Committee. He's been identified now as L. Stephen Witt, and Penn has this information in his newsletter, and I'll give you his address again. in case you don't have it and want to start subscribing. He has a monthly newsletter that is very valuable. He went to see the man, and the implication of or suggestion he had, I don't know whether he told Penn, I believe he told Penn that Joe Kennedy had appeased the Nazis during World War II, just prior to it, and the umbrella was a symbol of appeasement with Chamberlain and giving in to Hitler, and that John Kennedy had appeased the Castro forces and the communists, and the umbrella was a symbol of appeasement. Whether or not it was a weapon also, we don't know, but this man will be testifying before the House Select Committee. Bob Cutler wrote a book on the bullet direction, the trajectory of bullet 399. He wrote a book called The Umbrella Man, and I think that some of these witnesses should have given credit to these other critics, because the people watching national television should be aware of how many people are doing this work. But he did go into the story of Joseph Miltier and the fact that it appeared that he was not only taping the plans to kill John Kennedy 2 weeks earlier, but that he was, in fact, in Dealey Plaza the time of the assassination. He then presented the committee the famous tramp photos. He didn't say whether or not one of them was E. Howard Hunt or Frank Sturgis. He said these are presented by members of the critical community, the researchers, and the fact that the police took these men away and never fingerprinted or took their names should be investigated, and the fact that they were picked over at the railroad yard, which is where this man was seen fleeing, who allegedly was on that concrete wall. Somebody should account for this fact. And he pointed out that one man carrying or accompanying the tramps away is Fred Lee Chrisman. He's an extreme right-wing man. He lived in the Seattle area, and he was down in the South a lot, and he's dead. Groden mentioned that Chrisman and Miltier were both dead. There may be the possibility that because so many people are dead, they will say, in as much as Mr. Miltier is dead and Mr. Chrisman is dead and these various other people, we will never know. There are still many people alive that we could call as witnesses, but Miltier and Chrisman are no longer with us. He showed the James Algin photographs in front of the Texas School Book Depository. There's a picture of a man with a sweater, white shirt open, and it very much resembles Lee Harvey Oswald. And when the Warren Commission had these pictures, they interviewed a man named Billy Lovelady and said it was Billy Lovelady, but he had a dark shirt, dressed more like an FBI man, and his clothing didn't resemble the man in the doorway. And of course, if Lee Harvey Oswald watched the assassination from the street, he couldn't be upstairs on the sixth floor. I personally think that this is one of the poorest pictures to submit as evidence, because the House Select Committee will take the weakest points and build them up the most. If Lee Harvey Oswald were watching the motorcade and he were arrested, he was in the first floor having a Coke, he could have said, "I saw the motorcade," and recounted what took place and so forth. And if he saw the killing, he would still be out on the street instead of running in for a Coke. So if he was on the street, he had a cover, an alibi. And I think that, I don't know Billy Lovelady or anything about him, but there were many people in that area that resembled Lee Harvey Oswald, some that impersonated him up to the time of the assassination, and that could have been one of them standing in the door. He showed the picture of Lee Harvey Oswald holding the rifle at Neely Street and illustrated the differences in the shadows under the nose and the difference between the shadow directly, the sun directly over the head that would make the square triangle over the nose, and then the sun facing the rifle, the long shadows in back of the rifle, and a different time of day. Now, the things that Robert Groden presented that I'm recounting for you are not new for old researchers. It's not new material. But what is new is that nationwide, on national television, in at least 60 or 80 cities in the United States, if not more, it went out nationally to all cable TV. This was new for many people. And somebody who works closely with me, believe it or not, had never seen the tramp photographs. And many people had never seen the Abraham Zapruder film as close as it was. And this is a big selling point about the direction of the head. So the discrepancies of the shadows on the rifle that came out, say, to early researchers, certainly was not known to many people. And this is a whole new generation of people growing up who weren't aware of the discrepancies in the shadows. And he also showed the discrepancy of the rifle that Lee Harvey Oswald was showing. And he held the pictures, and he had a diagram. There were photographs of four rifles in this presentation. And one was a rifle that was ordered from Klein's gun store in Chicago that was supposed to be where Lee Harvey Oswald ordered this particular rifle. And one is the rifle that's in the National Archives that was supposed to be the murder weapon. And he shows the rifle that was photographed, the length of the rifle in proportion to the body of the picture at Neely Street in Texas, where Lee Harvey Oswald lived, and shows that there is 3 to 4 inches size difference in these rifles. And when you line them up, there's discrepancies, and they don't fit. If you hold them in the middle together, the ends don't lap over. They should all be the same rifle, and they were far from the same rifle. He also showed the different chins close up. The head that Lee Harvey Oswald said was his, superimposed on a body that wasn't his. Fred Newcomb, very fine researcher in Santa Monica, did this work. He did it, and a few people got on the bandwagon and took it and never gave him credit. I feel really badly about that. I just think it's terrible that the community of critics cannot work and help each other. We all help each other, but then somebody takes the information and just uses it. And Fred Newcomb was the one who did all this magnificent work. And you see a Lee Harvey Oswald with a pointed chin. It's quite clear. And then the other head is a straight chin. And one has a thin neck with a pointy chin. And one has a fat neck and a straight chin. He showed a picture of a rifle that didn't have enough identifying marks in it to conclude it was the one found in the Texas School Book Depository. And he went into the discrepancies of the various rifles. One, the first story that it was a German Mauser, an Italian Carcano, and he showed the differences of the ends of the barrel and the lengths and the trigger part itself, and how when they lined up, they didn't look like the same rifle at all. And of course, there was the controversy of the Oswald pictures, and he had a diagram broken down in inches of Lee Harvey Oswald in the Marines. He was 5'11". And then they show this picture of him with inches and so forth, and then the autopsy story of Lee Harvey Oswald. He was 5'9". Now, what he's saying here, he's bringing out many points. They also had pictures of Lee Harvey Oswald in the Soviet Union at a different size and height than the one that was in the service or the one that was in the Dallas-Fort Worth area. Now, that is a lot of information to bring to national television into the American home on any one day. What happens is that the media completely ignores it. I don't know in your hometown how you covered it or how it was covered, but I have our newspaper here, and this is the way they covered yesterday's testimony. They said, John F. Kennedy death scene, Connally's tell of silence and horror in assassination car. And this is George Lardner, Jr., from the Washington Post. And the article is two full columns down a page, and it's all about John Connally. Now, the Connallys testified in the morning and said hardly anything except that they reiterated that he said there were two shots, she said three. But then Robert Groden comes on with all this information in the afternoon, and there wasn't one article in our newspaper or in the Washington Post about Robert Groden. Groden went on to tell the committee that there were things that he was presenting that he didn't necessarily go with. In some ways, he was very advanced in bringing up all this material, and others, he said there were certain things that of this evidence that maybe he agreed with 1% and some of it 90%, but he said he will tell the committee what he doesn't agree with, and of course, they'll take his testimony and give no credence to some of this. I'm sure that he doesn't go along with the A.J. Weberman allegations that Howard Hunt was in Dallas or that Frank Sturgis was in Dallas, Texas. I understand that A.J. Weberman, who has been pushing the tramp photos and saying that the White House plumbers were in Dealey Plaza, has obtained a document written by James Angleton, a CIA document that's been declassified that states, how were we going to be able to explain that E. Howard Hunt was in Dallas the day of the assassination? Now, that doesn't mean he was photographed with Frank Sturgis, but E. Howard Hunt will be a witness before the House Select Committee, and I wonder if he'll be asked that question or if he'll be spared the embarrassment or he will continue to perjure himself and lie about that particular event. He seems to be covered so far that he was in Washington, but a new document has come out suggesting that he wasn't. But the important thing about the Grodin testimony on national television, and I still am quite a state of shock, I can't believe it, is that if there are hard rifle discrepancies, if the shape of the rifle that Lee Harvey Oswald allegedly ordered from the Klein's gun shop in Chicago is different than the rifle that was found behind the boxes at the Texas School Book Depository building, that opens up a whole line of inquiry that must be accounted for. I've broken the chain of command of how these things happen, but there is no appointed body in Washington and no group of researchers outside of myself that has addressed these questions and then looked for the answers to them. Also, that Oswald double story, if Oswald was 5'11 in the Marines and he was 5'9 at the cemetery, I think that I have spent a lot of time answering those questions, and that's why I bring up those meetings of the Warren Commission when Earl Warren wanted the body of Lee Harvey Oswald cremated before the Warren Commission began their work. When I went through the 26 volumes, I found 39 incidences of where one Lee Harvey Oswald was at a location when another man using that name was at another place. And I think that's important because the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court had ordered the cremation of physical evidence, the body of a man that was killed in a police department by Jack Ruby, and maybe the answer to the two sizes would have to do with why Earl Warren ordered the cremation of the body. And one member of the Warren Commission who's going to be testifying before the House Select Committee is Gerald Ford, and it would be very nice if Robert Blakey and the committee asked him about the meeting and the decisions to cremate the body of Lee Harvey Oswald. The name of Ramsey Clark comes up in terms of evidence that was missing at the National Archives, the brains of John Kennedy, and also it comes up in terms of the Martin Luther King assassination because Ramsey Clark was the Attorney General. It was Ramsey Clark who said as soon as Martin Luther King was killed as the Attorney General, in quotes, "It was a one-man job. There's no evidence of a conspiracy." That was on Friday. He said that right after Martin Luther King was killed. On Saturday, he said to the press, "An arrest is near. The murder solution is close. And there's no sign that the Klan was involved in killing Martin Luther King." On Sunday, he was on Meet the Press saying that he had the assassin on the run. And they asked him at the time, "You don't have a suspect. How could you have an assassin on the run?" And he said that they were after this assassin and there was absolutely no conspiracy to kill Martin Luther King. And even when the FBI had articles 2 weeks later saying there was a conspiracy because there were two or more people working with this Eric Starvo Gault, who turned out to be James Earl Ray, Ramsey Clark said no. But I think it's important to know that in 1966, Ramsey Clark, as the Attorney General, formed what is known as the Interdivisional Information Unit. That's the IDIU. And it was in response to civil rights agitations of Martin Luther King and Malcolm X. And the Attorney General wanted an intelligence operation that would, in quotes, monitor potential troublemakers and civil disturbances. So the Attorney General, Ramsey Clark, began to gather information from his IDIU on organizations such as community relations services, poverty programs, neighborhood and legal services programs, labor departments, and used agents of IRS, alcohol, tobacco, and firearms, the post office, the President's Commission on Civil Disorders. Now, that's important because this IDIU got over 42,000 intelligence reports on civil disorders and campus disorders. And famous activists that were involved in this were Robert Abernathy, Cesar Chavez, Coretta King, Bosley Crowther, and others, and Martin Luther King and Malcolm X. So I think it's interesting that the IDIU was formed by Attorney General Ramsey Clark to watch Martin Luther King, and then as soon as Martin Luther King was murdered, as the Attorney General, without any evidence at all, he said constantly the Martin Luther King murder points to a single actor. He referred to the suspect as an actor. Maybe he was under mind control and brainwashed, and he refers to him as that. and says that he's just a man on the run. As I say, the FBI called it a conspiracy. So the very person that Ramsey Clark was watching and harassing, and the FBI was telling that he should commit suicide, probably do them the favor and so they wouldn't have to kill him, this very Ramsey Clark, very person who formed this intelligence group against people using their civil rights, was the man who was putting down the idea of a conspiracy so strongly. And I think the Attorney General and the Justice Department, the FBI, have certainly showed their hands in these investigations, and the way, if they didn't plan these assassinations, they show their assistance in the way they're covered up. Now, next week we'll do our tape, as I promised, on Evel Younger, and then we'll get back to the House Select Committee. And as I said before on the other side, if you have any questions, World Watchers, just pick up the phone and call me, and I'll answer them. If you have any suggestions or ideas on the hearings, give me a ring or write to me, and I'll send you information either on a tape or on the telephone. In the meantime, if you can, watch the hearings because they're very excellent. This is Mae Brussel in Carmel, and I'll see you next week.